You're listening to
the Music Interval Theory Podcast with TC and Frank.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Music Interval Theory Podcast. I'm your host. You may call me Frank, and I'm excited about today's subject. We'll be talking about ethics in music. In fact, we had an open discussion about that some days ago, and I want to give you the recording in today's episode. I truly hope that you'll get a ton out of this content. We're all about sharing valuable insights and helping you grow as a composer and an artist in general. So let's jump into the content. We need input from other creators to shape our own voice and our unique taste. That is all, I think, necessary. But where's the line between inspiration and infringement? Right? That is the big question. And yes, we have the copyright law, which pretty much defines what you can do and can't do. But then we have lawyers who interpret the copyright law very differently. So that is why there are enough lawsuits out there. What about original compositions that we write? Where is our own line between inspiration and infringement? Also, when it comes to analysis and educational material, like recreations of existing works, for example, that would be officially infringement if we published that under our own names, right? And take or claim ownership of that. Obviously, the AI stuff, we can also tap into that. But let's stick maybe to original compositions and maybe give some insights into where our own lines are between inspiration and infringement.
Well, I guess inspiration and the forming of taste, it takes years, and it's basically a process of accumulation. You listen to all the music, and over time, your ideas basically start to grow unconsciously, I guess. That would be kind of my way to look at it. But the main problem, I would say, is when a melody or some idea pops up into your head, how can you be sure that it's an original idea and not something that's very close to something you already heard?
A famous case of Michael Jackson that came to Italy, and probably in radio he heard some music from an Italian singer, and years later he did a song that is a copy of this melody, exactly the copy, and the Italian singer won, but agree that there was no intentional copyright infringement. So Michael Jackson paid the damages and whatever, but there was no an intentional copyright infringement. It was just that motif pop-ups years later, and it's difficult to
yeah, it's very difficult
to get if this is an infringement or not.
I don't really know how you roll out the quick win videos, if I'm getting them in order from beginning or if everyone gets the same one at the same time, but you showed something about doing a variation, very deliberate variation, but good God, by the time you went from the little theme from Raiders of the Lost Ark to what you ended up with, there wasn't a hint of the original theme in that. I've had the experience of writing a half hour long piece of classical music. I was still performing on classical guitar. I put together a trio, cellist, violinist, and myself. We sat down and there was one theme that I had recurring throughout the whole thing. And I said, it just reminds me of something. I don't know what it is. The violinist started playing the opening from Scheherazade. Yes, I could see it. The contour of the melody was similar and it was distant enough that I didn't feel totally ashamed of myself. Also, it's out of copyright. A lot of classical music is. I've seen television composers take a well-known classical piece and just barely vary it and throw that into the mix. I don't, you know, if it's something that's 200 years old, obviously they're not going to get sued for anything. They're not taking someone's performance of that original work, and they are varying a little bit, but it really made me uncomfortable. It would give me like a sense of, oh, wow, that's familiar, would be my first reaction. And I think like, no, that's not the original. They've just changed a tiny bit and they're using someone else's work. So ethically, I would try to avoid that. And realistically, it's my two examples show that even trying to avoid that, it's possible to gain some inspiration to steal a little bit from someone else.
A similar thing happened to me years ago when I wrote some of those relaxation tracks that are usually like 30 to 60 minutes long. And they just live because of nice flowing melodies, more or less, and easy harmony in the background. So for whatever reason, I stumbled always into the Moon River melody, which is fantastic. And I definitely know where this came from because I always admired Henry Mancini. So I listened to a lot of his writing and I think it's brilliant up to this day. So I just saw that I gravitated towards these melodies that I've heard from Mancini quite often. And then I thought, okay, let's make this a conscious decision now. I will use a variation of that melody because obviously this would be infringement. I can't use that. So I did an effort to start with the exact melody and then stepwise walked away from that and tried to make it as different as possible to not lose the essence of this flowing line, but still not to have any obvious connection to Moon River anymore. I think it is actually not a bad thing if you recognize those connections, like, well, this is where it came from. If you don't even know, obviously you can't take this as an advantage because you don't know the source where you got this from. And then I'm not even quite sure if you learn anything from that. But in my case, luckily, I definitely knew where this all came from. And then, yes, avoid melodies. That is the biggest thing. The overall arrangement generally evokes, at least for me, emotions that I connect to the arrangement. And then I simply try to understand, what is it? Like, is it a growling brass thing in the low register that I liked? Or is it a sparkling thing on top of everything? You know, is it just the sound of the strings against a woodwind line? Really efficient. Especially if you do these based on your taste, not on everybody else's taste, because then you are very true to you being the artist, since you select the ones that resonate with you the most. And that is what I did for a long time. I don't care if the original author or creator did use the same steps, because nobody cares about that in the end. It's about the end result. So if I find a way to get there and create similar results emotion-wise, then this is brilliant. This is really perfect. Like, how can I get this wall of sound with just orchestral instruments? And what do I need to thicken and to add in terms of additional elements like synth parts or guitars? What functions do they have to cover? Just take care you don't copy the melodies. And you can still use existing work to refine your own taste to some degree. And I think it's necessary, actually. And then at some point, you will probably decide, well, this is not my style anymore. This is what I see happened to TC over the last probably 5 years. If you listen to the stuff that he did in all of these animation shows, it's completely different to what he likes doing now. Mainly because it's not commissioned work anymore, and he probably asks different questions. Like, what do I enjoy listening to? What do I want to explore today? And it's usually not another episode of the Gummy Bears. That's not what he's interested anymore. So I think it totally depends on where you are in your artistic journey. And also, if you found some of these things to be very helpful, you can always make the conscious decision to not use these things anymore from now on. And you will never be able to make those decisions if you never explored those things in the first place. And I think that is so important for artists. And this is also not possible, by the way, if you use AI. You skip all of these steps and you never get into the journey of discovering what you like, actually, and how you get there. That takes away really a lot of what it means to be an artist, I think. It's definitely to figure out, why do I like something, right? And one thing that I lived with, a score that I lived with for weeks, was from the movie Hook. John Williams, and in particular, Flight to Neverland. Because I wanted to understand, well, how does the motor work in the woodwinds? Why do I like it? How does the brass section work against it? What's the function? Why does it work? What's the register? And there are so many questions. Once you start going into whatever score, it doesn't matter which one you pick, just pick something that motivates you enough to stick to it. I think that is the hard part, to really stick to the same, I don't know how many pages it was, but, you know, 8 or 10 pages in the big score. To stick to that for a week or 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 2 months, no matter how long it takes you to fully understand what's going on so that you are able to recreate similar results without infringing on the original work. Well, this is what I did back then, 20 years ago or so, in Cologne a lot, when I listened to all of these Hans Zimmer things. That was the time when I changed my template from the key switch patches to having all the articulations laid out separately, because I started to mix all of the articulations together and find the right and proper blend between all of those various things to create a specific sound. And the fun part was, in the end, it worked, but it took me a month or so to finish a 1 minute section that was as close as possible to the original recording. And you always heard all the articulations play simultaneously. It was just a change in the balance, the volume balance and the mod wheel balance of all of them. And that is why it took me so long. But there was always tremolo playing with spiccato, with marcato, with sustained, always. Everything, all at once. The whole work was so overwhelming. That is why I stopped doing that. Again, it was pure experimentation.
From a different perspective, I just wanted to say that from this perspective of ethics and composition, I have found it really useful to compose a set of variations based on a theme by whoever. So I play the original, and then there for a while I was doing a lot of live performance, and I would take a piece by Fernando Sor, and the variations included electronics, looping, just pure classical variation on the same piece, and string them all together. But I found that it gave me the incentive to both mimic the original material, but also break away from it and to begin to play with that line a little bit. Of course, it was a 200-year-old piece, so nobody's going to come after me for doing it, but it gave me that experience of how to expand. Now that I'm in Mita, I kind of want to do some more variations on the same piece, because now I'm inspired to look at that process maybe a little differently.
I think it's very important technique. For example, Mozart stole from Claudio and I stole from Mozart. I had a really tricky transition. I was writing, it was years ago, I was writing an atonal piano piece, and it had kind of 4 different themes, very, very different between them. And I had a trouble transitioning from a portion of the piece that was about anger, dynamics, emotion. It was very, very dynamic section of the piece. And the next one was very peaceful. And so, like, I kind of struggled how to properly transition it. I was thinking, let's listen to some Mozart, obviously a tonal music, diatonic music, whatever, just kind of to get inspired. And I was listening to, I think it was Symphony number 40 or something like that. And at some point I hear some nice transitions. I was like, I'm going to steal this. And I took like 4 or 8 bars or that, took some rhythms and things like that. And I eventually ended up with a completely original transition that nobody is able to connect the dots. And it worked wonderfully. I was a great artist that stole from Mozart.
But I think that is actually exactly what Daniele, what you also talked about, which is essentially the gathering stage, right? And you decide, well, what is your source of inspiration? If it was an existing piece and you do variations on those, or if it was a rhythm, these are totally valid starting points, I think. And nobody owns a rhythm or owns a chord change or whatever. With the melody, it might be different. I understand that. So everything what is singable might be tricky. But aside from that, I think all of those are valid sources for us to take from. And we should do it. Why not? If it's available and if you resonate with a specific work, then it is a good match.
I did something different. I like a lot the Brahms symphonies. I wrote a melody and I decided to try to use the exact orchestration of the Brahms, and was really interesting the result, because it sound like Brahms, but the melody is completely different. The chord, if you want, are completely different. I just kept the structure and the orchestration.
That is almost the definition of learning, because you took something that clearly has worked for a successful composer in the past, and then you tried to make it your own.
Now, has anybody of you faced the situation that somebody stole your music?
I'm having a really strange time with something that Olafur Arnalds, of all people, I can't imagine that this could have happened, but there's a sound on one of his tracks that sounds, it's just a drone that I came up with, but I had to feed a Moog guitar, which has feedback built into it. So it was a kind of like having a Sustainiac going through a program that I had set up so that it took the guitar tones and transposed it to a B minor ninth chord or something like that. And it was a drone. And there's something absolutely, it was such an obscure path to get there that I can't imagine someone else would come up with it. But of course, if anybody could, it'd be Olafur Arnalds and the 27 people he probably has working for him. Still, it's like every time I listen to that track, it's like, I love this track, but damn it, that sounds like somebody scooped up my sound from the internet or something. And I don't know. Anyway, it's sort of a non-issue, but it's also something that has nagged at me for a while now.
Yeah, well, only accidentally somebody stole a lot of tracks, actually. I got in touch with a lot of music publishers and music licensing platforms in the past before I decided who I want to go with as an exclusive collaboration. So I sent them a lot of tracks, like, this is what I do. Maybe you find some good use with that. And what do you think? Do we want to sign a contract? And some of them said immediately, no, we are not interested, but thanks for all the tracks. And then they totally forgot that they don't have an existing agreement about those tracks. And they released them as part of a compilation. And I only found out because of a few other guys who also were part of this compilation. And they said, okay, well, this was definitely an accident. We apologize. And obviously they were very friendly. And I believe it always happens because a company grows too big and then, you know, the assistant has no idea what has to be done with those existing tracks, and they just find a folder on their external hard disk drive, and they want to be a good employee, and they put them all together into a compilation, and then things just move forward step by step. So I don't believe there is just one guy to blame for this. They are probably getting submissions every day from a lot of composers, and then somebody else picked them up from there and tried to make good use of the tracks, because that is what their business model is. That is why I'm not blaming them. They actually try to help their composers by putting stuff out, which is all good. But they should have checked if there is an existing agreement with this specific composer or not.
So did they at least retroactively set up an arrangement with you? So that
exactly, that was my question. Yeah.
Well, they actually did send me some money, because this was the easier way for them out. Right. So they said, OK, see, we will leave this compilation online so that they don't run into any costs. For that purpose, they just offered me a one-time payment, which I accepted. All is good. There was a compensation for that. Back then, it seemed agreeable to me. For that purpose, I said, yeah, sure. Before we bring in any lawyers or have any more email conversations, let's just leave it there and move forward. I think that is a better business decision for everybody involved. That brings us to the end of today's episode. And I want to mention that we had a huge section about AI in this conversation, and I want to show you that portion in a dedicated episode very soon. So please stay connected and subscribe to the podcast on your preferred channel. I truly appreciate you sticking around. And you can even take it one step further and actively support us. And if you want to do that, please rate our podcast and give it a shiny 5-star review. This would mean the world to me. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and we'll catch up soon.
This podcast is powered by the Music Interval Theory Academy, your resource for getting clarity and confidence in music composition and orchestration. See you inside at musicintervaltheory.academy.